And welcome to another edition of the Sea Control Podcast, your moment of PowerPoint rehab from the Center for International Maritime Security. As always, I am your host and president of SIMSEC, Matthew Hipple. Now, originally, today's podcast was going to be on the Office of Personnel Management hack by China. But through happy coincidence, I happened to hear Dean Chang, our guest, give a talk about soft power and journalism. Since the OPM hack has been in many cases beaten to death, we saw this as a pretty good opportunity and shifted today's podcast topic to that of his talk. We understand, but sometimes I don't think we appreciate the real power of journalism. We kind of take it for granted. We watch the news, we look at what's going on Twitter, we follow our Facebook feed, we watch TV, we listen to the radio, and podcasts. All this information, driven by its creators, their interests, and their underlying biases, drive the way we look at the world, and therefore how we act. Now, while in the United States we often talk about domestic political bias in the media, we don't spend as much time discussing how journalism can become a diplomatic tool of a foreign state. Because of all this information, even if we are free-thinking, even if we have our own philosophical concept for how the world operates, all these models we have internally for decision-making and prediction are really nothing more than equations. Equations that need data to gain a result. And whoever provides that data has an incredible amount of soft power. Today we try to break out of our shell of what we see as the news and what we turn on and see on our screens, and see how journalism is being developed as a tool by our strategic adversaries like China and Russia, and what that might mean for the United States. We also discuss, for China's case in particular, how this proliferation of media may affect our conventional understandings of how these outlets are used as diplomatic signaling devices for the Chinese state. But before we can get into the subtleties of soft power with Dean Chang, a quick break for a very unsubtle message from your team here at SIMSEC.
Just like the Office of Personnel Management gives away everybody's greatest secrets, SIMSEC and our Sea Control podcast are here to give you the greatest content on maritime security, technology, history, and international affairs. Of course, we couldn't do this without you. The podcast listeners, article readers, content contributors, conference attendees, and voluntary leaders. Sea Control isn't just a podcast, and SIMSEC isn't just a website. We are a labor of love by a dedicated community. China already has all of your personal information, so you may as well share a little bit with us. Consider signing up for a membership at www.cimsec.org/about/membership. Receive emails with our latest articles and events. Gain access to your own SIMSEC WordPress account, which will allow you to share articles with our editorial staff and your insight with a broader community. And remember, subscribe, like, and give 5-star rating to us on iTunes and Stitcher Stream Radio. We would still do this podcast even if you thought it was a horrible dumpster fire. But the nice reviews do make us feel a little bit better about ourselves.
And welcome back to Sea Control, your moment of PowerPoint rehab from the Center for International Maritime Security. I am here at the Heritage Foundation for their conference today on diplomacy and warfare in the 21st century. I'm here with Dean Chang, friend of the podcast, and we have completely changed the topic. You don't need to worry about what it used to be, but we just had a discussion on non-conventional tools of engagement, and there was some really interesting discussion on journalism, but first, Dean Chang, you have introduced yourself, I think, at least twice on our podcast already, but there's a question that I actually thought of on the way here, which is, has anyone actually confused you for an actual dean?
Yes. When I was in college, in fact, friends of mine would regularly answer the phone with Dean Chang's office. And so there were indeed folks who thought that there was somebody in the administration named Dean Chang.
That's perfect. I have a friend, John, whose last name I won't throw out on the podcast, but he's in a perpetual state of looking like a 40-year-old man, even though, you know, he may be 25. And so kids at one of the summer camps would call him Professor all the time. They had no idea that they were probably only 5 years younger than he was. So today's topic is going to be soft power engagement, specifically in the realm
of journalism. And this kind of inspired something that I've noticed. I'm a Roman Catholic, so I follow some of the news on the Pope, and I'm always amazed at how, breaking news, Pope says Catholic Church believes in science, which is, we have Vatican scientists. They have an observatory there. It shouldn't be news. It's not, and you wonder, especially in the West, here in the United States in particular, are journalists becoming less informed, more amateurish? What you brought up today, I thought was particularly incisive, and we'll start with talking about the Xinhua News Agency. So as we know, Dean Chang is the Heritage Foundation expert on China. What he brought up during today's conference was the penetration of Xinhua into Africa, and they're building legitimacy on coverage by having on-scene reporters. And we'll start today's podcast by giving you an opportunity to just set that up, just like you did during the talk, about how Xinhua is building that legitimacy and what that kind of means and how you've observed that legitimacy build.
Well, it's important to keep in mind several things. One is that the Chinese want to establish a credible presence in terms of global media. And so they have the money to do it, and they have been showing a willingness to spend the money to build that credibility. And so you have CCTV America with nice, shiny new headquarters here in Washington, D.C. You have Xinhua, which is the official state Chinese news agency, which has started a 24-hour English-language broadcasting service. You have Xinhua establishing bureaus in all the capitals in Africa. I believe it's all of them, but if not, it's very close, to the point where there are more Xinhua-accredited journalists covering African affairs than, I believe, AP, New York Times, Agence France-Presse, and Reuters combined. And more importantly, they are there. They are based in Abidjan. They are based in Kenya and South Africa and Nigeria and elsewhere so that they develop both in-depth knowledge and develop relations with local authorities, local business people, etc., so that they can provide that level of credible in-depth coverage. And Africa is only one example. They seem to be doing the same thing in South America, as they've certainly been doing it in Asia, and they're even doing it here in the United States. One of the things to keep in mind is the Chinese talk about something called public opinion warfare. And so the effort to develop this very large, comprehensive, global network of media outlets is in part intended so that in event of a crisis, much less wartime, that they can present a credible version of the story to the world, to an established audience, to influence global opinion, to influence other nations' policies, to undermine the will to resist on the part of whoever their target is, and to deter the United States, whom they do consider, as we've seen in their most recent defense white paper, to be the foremost potential adversary to Chinese interests.
So before we delve in more to the theoretical aspects of this, let's compare what we just described of the purpose and drive of Xinhua and the news agencies. And actually, side note, when I was in New York for Fleet Week, it was interesting to see. I think it was the Xinhua News Agency has a billboard in New York, right below or across from the ball that drops on New Year, which I was shocked and I thought was telling. But so Xinhua, professional-driven journalistic operation that's designed to drive a specific narrative and dig itself into the sources of information that people use. You also spoke about RT. So describe sort of the purpose of what you see RT as, because, I mean, let's be serious. They have a correspondent that specializes in the Illuminati. So it's not like they're the same kind of caliber of organization and same purpose that Xinhua is. So describe, kind of contrast what Xinhua does with the reason the RT exists and what they're used for.
Well, I do think it's a... Let me preface everything by saying I am not an expert on the Russian media. So my comments here are as an interested outside observer. RT is much closer to overt propaganda. RT basically has a stable of folks who they call upon in terms of outside experts, etc., who have a very consistent line, and that line is all of the problems in the West. So rather than trying to build credibility, they are trying to influence. And their target is different from the Chinese target. The Chinese openly talk about three broad sets of audiences. You have your domestic audience in China, you have your potential adversary audience, and you have your third-party audience. I think that in the case of RT, what you have is much more of a focus on one audience. And interestingly, that audience is Russian. It is their domestic audience. That what they are doing is broadcasting examples, evidence, what have you, of how the rest of the world is certainly no better than Russia, in many cases maybe worse than Russia, and therefore to confuse, to obfuscate, and to cloud the debate, to raise doubts, but in a fairly ham-handed fashion. Frankly, I think that RT has a shorter time frame, time horizon. I think that they are operating on a how do I influence people now, or maybe next week, over things like Ukraine. I think the Chinese, they have a different strategic situation, they have a different cultural history, they have a different outlook on the problems, they have a lot more money, which buys you out of problems, can afford, therefore, to take a much more longer-term view of let me establish a credible global news agency that, if necessary, I can use at some future point to influence all three audiences.
So the next question is going to drive kind of more into the theory of Dean Chang's personal opinion, of course, maybe not so much within the realm of China as a specialty. But so we have Xinhua. They are building a legitimate and in-depth news organization that's building relationships with local populations, which creates possible inroads for influence as well as information dissemination and collection. How far do you think the United States has disadvantaged itself? And I say that roughly, because our media is not the United States. It's not state-driven. But with new media and Twitter and folks trying to divest from that old media model, how far do you think the United States has disadvantaged itself in this soft power media battle? Because most of our news seems to be about Donald Trump and Kim Kardashian, and that could just be me being bitter. Have we disadvantaged ourselves, or is this sort of griping on our part? Do we still have a very strong brand in things like CNBC, CNN? There's also other Western news agencies like the BBC, and there's still the AP, there's still Reuters, there's still all the different wire reporters that may have a certain level of legitimacy. Where do you feel that we stand in the balance of what the media empire that China is building and what we have in the West to counter that narrative, or at least to build our own narrative?
Don't be bitter. Bitter's not bitter. I think that first off, I think it's very important to separate the terms legitimate and credible. I think the Chinese are building a credible news agency, in part because it is less overtly propagandistic. But it is important to remember, both Xinhua and CCTV are ultimately state-run media. So how legitimate is that? That depends. But it is important to recognize that ought to call into question, you know, how objective is their reporting? Does their reporting serve other functions than simply reporting the news? So that's the first aspect. Are we disadvantaged? Anytime you have the raucous confusion of democracy versus the unified stamp of state-run authoritarianism. State-run authoritarianism always wins in the short run because you can mobilize, you can do all that sort of stuff to get something, one thing done or a handful of things done. In the long run, the problem for the Chinese or the Russians is that you do have populations that are restive, that are not happy with their points of view, with their gripes, with their concerns, not having a voice. And so that's part of the function. Keep in mind, what is the purpose of news? Part of the purpose of news is to serve as a feedback mechanism for government to know what is going on and to hopefully address the problems, for information dissemination within the structure of the system. Hey, something's going on elsewhere. We might want to avoid it. We can learn lessons from it, etc. That does not, neither of those mechanisms, the feedback mechanism, the cross-fertilization mechanism, doesn't happen the more controls you put onto news, the more controls you put onto information. So that's a longer-term benefit cast against the short-term price, if you will, of, yes, lots of confusion, lots of voices, how do you figure who's legitimate, etc. Now, with regards to, Kim Kardashian or Caitlyn Jenner or Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton or any of these other things, part of the price you pay for that raucous caucus, if you will, is who makes the decision on what is newsworthy. Well, what you don't have is somebody from on high saying, this is worthwhile, that is not. Now, where I do have more of a problem is that we have a body of journalists, many of whom are often ill-informed about what used to be common basic knowledge. Mm-hmm. When someone says, that the Constitution, is it even 100 years old? That's a regrettable, but it raises even more questions about, if you don't know that, then what is your framework for judging the Constitution or constitutional issues? If you really have no idea about the difference between a flintlock pistol and an M16, and everything is an assault weapon, then in that case, that does raise questions about how accurately you're reporting on, be it the tragedy in Chattanooga or the tragedy in South Carolina. If you don't know about the separation of powers and what is within the purview of each of the branches, then in that case, how do you judge whether or not a presidential, congressional, or Supreme Court action is legitimate or not? Part of this is the responsibilities of each of us as a citizen, but as a journalist, you have a particular responsibility. As a great philosopher once said, with great power comes great responsibility. Journalists are granted a huge amount of leeway. They are, very difficult in the American system to charge them with libel and with slander and all the rest. But the price for that is a responsibility to be informed before you go and write your stories, to know the basic facts, to familiarize yourself with the basic knowledge, and above all, to try and be objective, because to my mind, and this is purely Dean Chang's opinion, the function of the press is to be the people's intelligence agency. We've talked in the past about the problems of politicized intelligence, etc., and how bad it is for the president to demand or expect that the intelligence agencies will modify their information to fit a preset agenda. How does the American public make a decision about something? How do they get informed? Mm-hmm. They depend upon the media. If the media fails to be objective, the media arrogates to itself the right, well, we're not going to talk about that other perspective, or we're just going to downplay it, or we're just going to ignore it, then how can we expect the American public to make an informed choice or decision? And that is, I think, the greatest danger, is that, in a sense, you create all of the ill effects of a top-down media, like what we see in Russia and what we see in China, except that it is not top-down from the government. It's not even top-down from the owners, necessarily, of fill-in-the-blank media entity, but rather it is editors and others who have, as I said, arrogated to themselves the right to decide what the public, quote-unquote, needs to know.
You know, it's interesting driving down to that point, as you're talking, I'm thinking about how long it takes to build that body of knowledge and that intelligence. And when you say about credible and legitimate, there's a certain point where if you lack a certain amount of credibility, you stop being legitimate. And you don't build expertise. You know, Rome wasn't built in a day. So if you have groups like Xinhua going out, building the relationships, being on the ground with the new media model, a lot of these news agencies have pulled out of these areas. And they'll send remote reporters if an event happens. Christina Amanpour will go out onto the scene. But you can't just airdrop reporters into areas, and that puts us at a grave disadvantage. As you're discussing, you spoke on the domestic side, but on the international sphere, having us with our own people with an American background who believe in our kind of system or from our system reporting on the news, you'll have Xinhua reporters who know the local officials, who have been there, who see, and they're giving a report, whereas you have someone from the New York desk of the... from the New York office of New York Times, and they'll just show up in Libya and start asking questions. And suddenly our ability to generate our own... I mean, these people don't act, as we've discussed, collectively for the whole people, but generally speaking, people from our team, in quotes, their ability to generate the story is lost, and we only have one narrative left. But... you know, we're deep into the theory, but since you are the China man, let's dig back into how this mechanism of journalism is used. So we're talking about the weaknesses that we may have. We're talking about the strengths that can be created and how they're designed. So let's talk functionally, practically. So China's building this media empire and building maybe has already built. How do you see it being used now? How do you see its influence in the real time? How is this investment being returned to the Chinese government? Do we see that yet? Do we really see that sort of OODA loop being linked on how they're getting a result on watching people react to this news, on collecting this news, on affecting that narrative? Or is this something that's really only just coming to play?
Well, I think, again, that the Chinese are playing a long game here. I think that, you know, it is in our nature to say, so what have we, you know, what results are we already seeing? Mm-hmm. I would note that when the Pentagon was still producing the early bird, the news clipping service, they were clipping Xinhua news items and putting them alongside New York Times and AP items, which one suggests a level of credibility, mm-hmm. whether rightfully or not. But two, meant that the readership of the early bird, which included obviously senior defense officials and military officers, were getting their news at least somewhat through a Chinese filter. Now, not always, not consistently, but that is a real-time, real-world aspect. Does that mean that General Schmedlap or Admiral Fussbottom necessarily changed a decision because of that? No, not at all. But it presented an opportunity to do that sort of, to borrow a phrase, the Chinese water torture, right? Of the drip, 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 where I'm not going to change your perspective with one story or one action. But over time, maybe I can shade your views. Maybe I can have some influence. Maybe you will put a little more weight on one side or a little less weight on the other. And that, at the end of the day, is really what I'm trying to achieve here, is not to get you to suddenly wake up, renounce America, and sail your carrier group into a Shanghai and hand it over. But it is to say, maybe this is not a good course of action to voice an opinion, to oppose a course of action, to raise doubts in the civilian leadership's mind. That's more of the focus.
So, a thought. Part of the traditional understanding of dealing with China, I'd say, maybe when its media reach wasn't as great. So maybe, say, a decade or more ago. It was very well understood. If a message came out in a certain venue, It was to be understood, hey, this came from this person, or if this kind of message came out, it was very easy to understand, and signaling was clearly established. This is how much they believe this message. This is why they're putting it out, because it's from this person in this venue sent out to this group. So the media groups were almost used like, I don't know, signaling flares. How does this greater media body that's being created by the state and also organically affect that? Is this to our advantage? Is this to our disadvantage? How does this change the nature of how what used to be a very conventional and well-understood signaling system, how is this affected by what China has built?
Well, it certainly complicates all of our lives. That's why so many China analysts these days have gray hair.
yours is firmly still brown, so...
blowing my cover there. But this is...
Do you diet? It's okay.
This is a fundamental... No. this is a fundamental problem here. As you said, once upon a time, what was in People's Liberation Army Daily? What was in People's Daily? What was on the Xinhua news wires? For example, a fundamental question keeps cropping up. How seriously should we take Global Times? Mm-hmm. Global Times is put out by the folks who I believe put out People's Daily. People's Daily is still the party newspaper. It is, you know, the paper that, you know, whatever is on the headlines is certainly reflects important views and positions by the CCP leadership. You will find in-depth analyses ostensibly by Xi Jinping, Li Keqiang, etc. You know, so that's what you read. So when Global Times comes out and declares that, you know, Japanese actions are on the verge of causing a war, or American actions are bringing us to the brink of crisis, is that the same thing as a People's Daily headline? And the Chinese themselves will say, no, this is a tabloid. Well, okay.
So why are you doing it?
But it is put out by People's Daily's, you know, sort of overall publishing entity. So this is creating an interesting problem. China has proliferated the number of outlets. There are more newspapers, some of which seem to actually be commercial / privately held. Now, we do get the sense that the Chinese still exercise some level of editorial control. But exactly what the extent of that is, you know, there are online groups who monitor Chinese news guidelines. I believe one of them goes by the title Ministry of Truth. I tipped the hat to 1984. So we know that there are directives that come down that say, do not cover X, do not mention Y. But how does that, you know, I think where that reflects is a loosening of a grip on some things, simply because of the proliferation of outlets. But at the same time, a continued grip, but there are some things you really don't want to mess with. We're not kidding. This is absolutely, you know, to be discussed or not to be discussed. But it makes our lives as outsiders who are analyzing China, China media, what policy pronouncements matter, it makes our lives harder because there is not only a proliferation of sources, but it's made determining credibility much harder.
And I think that's a good place to end.
Okay.
Excellent. Are there any thoughts? We've had an entire day of conference, and you've been talking to different folks from different backgrounds. So just kind of open it up. Yours was non-conventional tools of engagement. We've been talking about journalism, but to close out, open it. Is there anywhere that you think that our listeners should go to discuss or learn about this particular topic? Or is there something interesting from today that you heard, or a particularly incisive question that you really grappled with, something to throw our listeners that's maybe a little bit off the beaten path of our conversation so far?
Well, I think that one of the things that we did try to bring out during more of the Q&A sessions was the importance of understanding that the competition that the U.S. and China are engaged in particular is multivariate. It is not a military competition. It is not an economic competition. It is not a political competition. It's all of these things. Mm-hmm. And it's diplomatic, it's science and technology, and it's cultural. The Chinese talk about cultural security. That's something we don't tend to think about as much, but the Chinese do. So it is, you know, it would be very, very wrong and very, very dangerous to think, okay, we are heading back into a Cold War and containment, military, political alliances, etc., when in fact, in many ways, it's more a more comprehensive struggle that we and the Chinese are engaged in. If anything, it more closely resembles, say, 1947 to 1955, before it was all military and set into alliances that glared at each other across the inter-German border. That, you know, back then, when we were thinking about a competition of ideologies, a competition for influence, a competition of presenting a different way of life by both sides, that is what we are looking at in some ways with regards to China. The good news is that means that we can cooperate with China, we can trade with China. It doesn't, you know, it is not a total zero-sum situation. The bad news is that the Chinese are competing with us in areas, including media and the like, where we're not even thinking about it as a competition. And that is probably unhealthy. The other piece I would probably just throw into all of this is, for those who are interested in the issue of political warfare, particularly the three warfares, I'll take this moment here to do a little self-advertising and say that if you go to the Heritage Foundation website, you can find papers that were written on discussing what the Chinese have written, and that's a very important point here. This is not just Dean Chang's opinion. This is Dean Chang's opinion based upon footnoted reference to a lot of Chinese language material on legal warfare, public opinion warfare, and psychological warfare.
Like the white paper, Unrestricted Warfare.
Which
deals in it tangentially. It doesn't specifically.
Yes.
You have negative thoughts on that?
Yeah, I don't know if you want to put this into your
No, that's fine.
Or not. Okay. So, Unrestricted Warfare was written by two colonels in the PLA.
Mm-hmm.
But it was written
by Air Force colonels, right?
But it was two military officers. But it's what's important to recognize is it was written by two colonels in the military. It was not written as a doctrinal document, which it has too often been referred to as.
Yeah.
It was not written as an official imprimatur. There is, in fact, an entire body of methods of analyzing Chinese published materials to look at whether or not it is authoritative. And Unrestricted Warfare did not hit almost any of those other than, it was written by two military officers. This goes, in fact, to the very proliferation of media outlets that we were talking about earlier, which is to say that China's military publishing system publishes a lot of material. It publishes it for very different reasons. Sometimes it is to say, hey, this is no kidding, official doctrine, all of you need to read it. Sometimes it is, hey, we're having a debate about the subject, let's air some different points of view. Sometimes it is, hey, this is a particular service or a particular perspective, authoritative, but not necessarily for the entire PLA. And sometimes it is outright for profit. Because there are people who are interested in reading about how Chinese officers think about things. You know, not everything that is written by a retired U.S. military officer reflects U.S. doctrine. You know, Ralph Peters and others have written fun novels that I think are far less to be taken as a reflection of U.S. military policy than a joint pub. And so, but I think we have looked at Unrestricted Warfare as though it was a joint pub rather than, you know.
It's far more readable.
It is. It's far more readable. It's far more exciting. It's far more interesting. But that doesn't mean
that. Which probably is indicative of why it's not as authoritative as a joint pub.
In many ways. Because Chinese joint pubs, we don't actually have a copy of Chinese joint pubs, but documents from the Chinese that are more authoritative are indeed drier. They are, and they are much more sort of organized along particular lines. Doesn't mean that the ideas in Unrestricted Warfare are necessarily wrong. It doesn't mean that the ideas in Unrestricted Warfare aren't worth thinking about. But we should avoid the mistake of saying, oh, this is how the Chinese are going to fight the next war. No. This is how two colonels were musing about how China should think about fighting the next war. Probably reflects some of their education and some of their inside knowledge, but does not necessarily reflect doctrine, does not reflect official policy, does not mean that this went out to all of the commands and all of the officers and was required reading.
You know, that's a good... After our conversation about the Chinese media juggernaut, it's kind of a good reflection to take this particular moment and take sort of all of our presumptions about the, I don't want to say insidiousness, that's the wrong term, but the very particular planning and execution, and look back and say how maybe that very foundational idea of how we view a lot of what they do, turning into documents like that may be not innocuous, but just amusing, and we'll look at that and go, oh, they had it printed under two kernels because they didn't want to make it look important, but it's signaling and what have you, and really sometimes a amusing document is a just amusing document. It's not necessarily some sort of insidious plan to undermine the United States.
China has a population of 1.3 billion. Much as the government would love to be able to organize all of them and every one of their actions in a coordinated, integrated, unified approach, all 1.3 billion pulling together, the reality is that China is several thousand years old. In the course of that time, it has developed bureaucracies that are thousands of years old. Not literally. But as a result, you have competing perspectives, competition for resources, and you have folks who are off base, folks who are operating off a different sheet of music. And when you throw in the profit motive, sometimes they're writing and saying stuff purely for the sake of making some money.
Well, it has been a pleasure. Dean Chang.
Same here.
Thank you as always.
Thank you for having me, as always.